Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Every Monday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another man who has walked his own journey and agreed to share it with us. Today's guest has actually walked a fairly unique journey. I am pleased to introduce to you Jeremy Gavron, who is an award-winning author, a former foreign correspondent in both Africa and Asia. He currently lives in London and teaches in the MFA program at Warren Wilson College in North Carolina. Jeremy Gavron, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks very much, Pamela. Good to be with you.
Now, Jeremy, you have written a book. It is essentially a memoir, but it is entitled A Woman on the Edge of Time. So, give us a thumbnail sketch of how a man's memoir is titled A Woman on the Edge of Time.
Well, you know, it's a memoir, but it's also not a memoir because its subject is my mother, who died when I was 4 years old, and I don't remember her. So it's sort of part memoir, part biography, part detective story. But perhaps the simplest thing for me to do is to try and take you back to where the book both, in a way, both ends and begins, which is London in 1965. And this was London of the swinging 60s, the new ideas in the air, new music, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the sexual revolution. And my mother was 29 at the time, just young enough to embrace that new world. And she, the pictures of her from that time show her with a new 1960s bob hairstyle, wearing mini skirts. This is from the very end of her life. And yet she was also a serious academic. She had, at that time, had just finished and was about to be published a book called The Captive Wife, which was a study of young women, young mothers at the time, the fact that, when it came out after her death, it caused quite a stir in suggesting that women weren't entirely happy necessarily to stay at home with their children, which was a sort of new idea in the 60s.
Indeed.
And she was a mother of two young children herself, my brother and me. She had a good job. She had no history of illness or mental illness. And suddenly, out of the blue, it seemed to everybody who knew her, she committed suicide. And my father and to a degree my grandparents, my mother's parents, decided that in their sort of shock, horror, grief, anger, humiliation, shame, all these the legacies of a suicide like this, decided it was best if we didn't talk about her, if we tried, seemed to me, to forget her. And so I grew up knowing very, very little about her. And the taboo of silence was so strong in my house that it wasn't, even though I became a journalist and then began to write books, it wasn't until I was in my 40s, you know, much older than she was when she died, that I felt able to begin to ask questions about her. And I began to ask questions, I began to want to know who she was and why she died, and that's eventually what became this book. And that path led me not only to exploring my mother's story, but to explore the story of what it was like to be a woman, to be a young feminist, a woman wanting to have it all, you know, as the 1960s, almost for the first time in history, seemed to be allowing women or suggesting women could have. So that's sort of where why the title has a resonance, because it's not just my mother's story, but it's the story, to an extent, of women at that time in history.
Well, as you indicated, your mother actually committed suicide. So
yes.
What was that like for you, this journey, this detective story, which in many ways, you're right, it absolutely is. What was that like for you, learning about the mother you never knew post a suicidal death?
Well, it was a roller coaster emotionally. And it's something, to be honest, it's something I think I've been doing in one way or another all my life, ever since she died. We didn't talk about her when I was young, and I soon forgot her. I have no memory of her at all, but I never forgot that she'd existed. So she was there in my mind, in the back of my mind, occasionally in the forefront of my mind, all through my childhood into my adulthood. And there were moments when I would discover little things about her, find things around the house, even though most of her possessions were also thrown away. So that process, that sort of emotional up and down, was something that I'd become used to in my life, although it was done entirely in private. And then I began, I mean, it was another death in the family that prompted this process. My brother, my mother's other son, who was 3 years older than me, died suddenly of a heart attack when he was in his mid-40s. And in the sort of aftermath of his death, the sort of extraordinary sort of force of feeling I felt, I began to feel that I wasn't just mourning him, but an older grief was also surfacing. So it began, the whole process began from emotion. It was about feeling, because I have no memory of her, but I seem to have a very powerful emotional memory, so that I can be very moved by things I find and hear about her. And I began at that point to start talking to people, start asking questions. Initially, not the family, but people outside the family, because it was easier to talk to people who'd known my mother, friends of hers, and one person would pass me along to the other. And each person I met would tell me something different, things that would make me happy, things that would disturb me, things that would upset me. I remember as a child, I'd created a sort of fairy tale version of my mother. So when I began for the first time to hear about the real person, it was quite difficult at first to hear that she wasn't a sort of perfect fairy tale princess, as I'd imagined, that she was an ordinary, flawed, if quite extraordinary human being. So, through the whole process, there were so many different things I found out, and my emotions were just riding up and down all the time.
Early on in A Woman on the Edge of Time, you talk about the suicide of someone named Nicholas Hughes, and you were particularly moved by that death, that suicide. Tell us why. Why did it have such an impact on you?
Well, Nicholas Hughes was the son of Ted Hughes, the great British poet, and Sylvia Plath, the great American poet. And Sylvia Plath, as you know, committed suicide. She was 30, so she was a year older than my mother. And she committed suicide in London, in Primrose Hill, the same part of North London where my mother died, in the same way as my mother, by gas, 2 years earlier. So my mother's was, you could see it almost as a copycat death. Both young women with two young children who'd been having problems in the marriage, killing themselves a street apart in the same way. But there were also great differences between them. Sylvia Plath, as many of your listeners I'm sure will know, suffered from mental illness and had made suicide attempts all through her life, as she recorded in her poetry. And my mother had no history of mental illness, so that's a sort of important difference. Anyway, what happened to me was at some point after my brother's death, when I was sort of in this emotional turmoil, I read an article in a British newspaper about Nicholas Hughes, who had committed suicide himself. And this article talked about his experiences, and there were so many things that seemed to be expressing my own experience. The fact that his father hadn't wanted to tell him that his mother had committed suicide, the fact that he had been deeply affected by a second death. In his case, it was his father's death. In my case, it was my brother's. And there were other similarities too. And I felt it was almost like a ghost sort of crossing me, the shadow of a ghost crossing me. And I then wrote an article in a British newspaper. I was sort of prompted to write an article in a British newspaper about what I'd sort of felt in response to this death. And that, in fact, what that led to was people writing to me. And that was really what gave me my first leads on my mother's story, because I didn't know who to talk to about it. My family wouldn't talk about it, and I didn't know any of my mother's friends. In fact, I discovered that quite a lot of the people I'd grown up around me, my father's friends, had in fact been my mother's friends. Neighbors had known her. So played an important role for me in prompting the story, and also it gave me a sort of a sort of permission, because here was Sylvia Plath, the sort of famous, terribly sad story of Sylvia Plath that, you know, what was much investigated and much spoken about. And my mother, the parallels that I began to see with my mother's story sort of gave me a permission, suggested to me that this was a piece of history that I was investigating. So it gave me an excuse, permission to break the family taboo.
The family tradition of silence really sounds like it was quite stunning in its completeness.
Well, I think it was in those days, it wasn't that unusual. And it was, you know, as I said, with Ted Hughes did the same with his own children, I think. I don't know whether he didn't talk about Sylvia Plath, but he certainly didn't tell his kids she'd committed suicide. And I know that Nicholas Hughes' sister had found out when she was about 15 at boarding school that her mother had committed suicide. I'd read about that. But I think people just didn't in those days have the emotional language, emotional intelligence. I mean, this is a recently coined term, emotional intelligence, the sort of psychological acuity, both to understand, to deal with, to address such a difficult issue. I mean, you know, today it's still, I would say, the most difficult thing that can happen to a family is a young suicide of someone in good health. You know, how do you explain it? How do you address it? How do you deal with the rejection of someone you love and you believe, and someone who you believe loved you, ending their life? And we still struggle to cope with how to process that. And back 50 years ago, I think people just did not have the language or the ability to do so. And so the easiest thing was to try and just to move on, to look ahead, to pretend almost that it hadn't happened. And in my family, my father was, I think, particularly suited to doing that. He always was someone who preferred to look ahead. And he married again quite quickly and had more children, which was an absolute lifesaver for me, because my half-sisters, who are my beloved sisters, came along and were like elixirs of life in the household, and had a young stepmother who was, you know, very attentive and loving. I didn't grow up in a sad household, but there was this secret. It was almost like there was a secret room in our house with a door that you weren't allowed to open. A mother who had been forgotten. It was almost as if we were pretending that she'd never existed. So the force of that taboo was so strong that even though, you know, perhaps you can even tell with the way I come across, I'm not a sort of shrinking violet. I'm someone who addresses problems, who talks about things, who pushes. I became a journalist asking questions. And yet even so, I still felt unable. It wasn't even that I felt unable. It never occurred to me that this was a possible area for me to go intellectually. Until really I was sort of well into adulthood, until I had daughters of my own. And I think that was a major part, having daughters of my own and then beginning to ask me questions about their grandmother. So I finally had the sort of strength to break this taboo. And it still was not difficult. You know, I first, as I said, began talking to people outside the family, but eventually I had to come to talk to my family, particularly to my father. And that was not easy to do.
I noticed as I was going through the book that it seemed to me that the constant reference to your mother was by her name, Hannah, but not mother. Am I correct? Was that intentional? Am I incorrect?
Well, I never, you know, I don't remember her. So, and I never called my mother, my stepmother, mother, mummy, or mom, you would say in America. So the mother is an alien concept almost to me. I don't remember ever calling anybody mum or mummy. And I always thought of my mother as Hannah. That's how people would talk about her. My grandmother, the only person who did talk about her when I was young was my grandmother, her mother, who would tell me a few handful of stories about her sort of childhood mischiefs and adventures. And she always called her Hannah. So I grew up thinking about her as Hannah. You know, if I was to call her mum or... that doesn't really make sense. And even to me, emotionally, and even my mother, feels quite a sort of formal way of describing her. So I think of her as Hannah. So that just came naturally to me in writing, calling her that in the book.
You talk about a friend of Hannah's named Sonia, who said that you looked very much like your mother. And I think that was the first time anyone had said that to you. What did those words feel like as you heard them?
Well, there was a very moving moment. She was one of the very first people I spoke to in that process. My grandmother had always told me from when I was young about Hannah had had these two very good friends when she was very young, these sisters called Sonia and Tasha. And I'd met the other sister, Tasha, a few times, but she was ill by the time I started to research the book. So I went to see the other sister, Sonia, who'd known Hannah all her life. And I went down to Bristol, I live in London, and Bristol is a couple of hours away on the train. And Sonia came to meet me at the train station to pick me up, to take me back to her house, to spend some time talking. And she just looked me up and down as I came walk down the stairs from the train station into a sort of relatively small car park, and obviously knew immediately who I was. And she just said, "Yes, you look like your mother." And no one had ever said that to me before. It bizarrely had never even occurred to me. I mean, this is the force of the taboo, that it had controlled, almost sort of closed off areas of thought for me. By then I had some photographs of my mother, even when she was young, of Hannah, and she looked remarkably like my older daughter. So I'd noticed that connection, but I'd never thought to think, do I look like her? And I came home that night and I stood in front of the mirror with a photograph of Hannah and comparing myself and realizing that I do. I have the same sort of broad jaw and full lips, and a lot of the sort of feel of my face is like her. And it was like an epiphany. You know, maybe this person really was my mother. I have this sort of, you know, proper connection to her, physical connection to her. It was very exciting and moving.
It's such an emotional moment when you feel that connection. And I would think, at the same time that it's emotional, it's also kind of odd, because you really don't know this person whom you look like.
No, and I still don't really know her. I mean, I know her in some ways better than most sons know their mothers. I've sort of investigated all aspects of her life. I know all about her teenage years. I've sort of investigated her teenage love life, and there was a particular reason for doing that, which we'll come to. And I remember at one point sort of, you know, talking to my daughters, who were teenagers at the time, about this, and them sort of saying, you know, come on, Dad, you know, give the poor girl a break. It's almost like I was sort of reading their phone, they were imagining, reading their private messages. So in some ways I know more about her than most sons would know about their mothers, but I still don't feel, I still have no memory of her. I sort of hoped as I began this process that something might come back to me, but it hasn't. It's that force of the taboo, I guess, is so deeply ingrained that I, you know, not even a sort of sense of her, a smell, a memory of a color or a feeling, and nothing. Yet I can remember the day after she died with immense clarity, my father sitting my brother and me down on his and my mother's bed to tell me that she was dead. And that is such a clear memory in my mind. And it was interesting because for a long time I sort of wondered whether that clarity of memory was a sort of falsification of the mind. But then during the process of researching this book, I went back, not to the actual house that I had grown up in, because strangers were living there and I didn't feel confident about knocking on their door, but I went to the next door house, and these were six identical houses, had been built in exactly the same way and also decorated in exactly the same way. And our neighbor was still, from my mother's day, was still living in that house. And I went up to her bedroom, which was still decorated in the way it had originally been decorated. I mean, obviously, it had been many times redecorated, but she'd kept the basic decor, the white walls, white carpet, big window with the sun shining through, which was exactly how I'd remembered it. So it was that was a very eerie moment. But also, it was, there I am. I remember that day with immense clarity, yet before it, just utter blackness.
When your dad sat you and your brother down to tell you that mother had died, did you have an understanding of what that actually meant?
Well, I'm not sure I can properly answer that, because, you know, how do you know whether, you know, the memory is refracted through the years and through so many re-rememberings.
True.
What I remember, I don't remember the words he said, but I remember this feeling of sort of, I remember the feeling as if the room was filling up with something, as if like a cloud, a sort of clear cloud, a sort of heaviness descending, and a sort of feeling of, I don't know, it's almost like a sort of Emily Dickinson poem, those poems in which she talks about how sort of grief is like a sort of a tolling of a bell or something like that. And I remember a feeling of great heaviness, and of this filling the entire room. So I think to some degree I must have understood.
Yes. Jeremy, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to pick up with your mom's teen years, which you referred to a moment ago.
Okay.
Folks, stay where you are. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll be right back. Jeremy Gavran, author of A Woman on the Edge of Time, a son investigates his trailblazing mother's young suicide. Jeremy, what did you learn about your mom as a teenager? What was her life like?
Well, she grew up outside London, even though they were Londoners, the family. She grew up outside London because the family had moved out during the Blitz, the bombing of London. And so they'd moved into the countryside. And she grew up, and she was the first thing that she fell in love with was horse riding, which is not the normal thing that an urban Jewish family would necessarily take up. But because she was living in the countryside and associating with local people, she became a very keen show jumper and actually became very good at it. She was winning sort of national and local competitions as a show jumper. But she gave that up when she was about 12 to go away to boarding school. And she went to a progressive mixed boarding school, which was quite unusual for those days. We're talking about the 1940s, late 1940s, where I think she had an interesting time. She was quite a sort of charismatic and vivacious character and became one of the real characters of the school. But one of the stories that my grandmother had sort of told me, or the details that my grandmother had told me in as I was growing up, was that my mother had had an affair with her headmaster at this school. And in my way of sort of processing and dealing with information like that, I'd always assumed, because I think my grandmother's stories were partly designed to show how precocious Hannah was, and therefore in a way to exculpate my grandparents from responsibility that they might feel for her death, you know, that if Hannah was this difficult, precocious person who had never been controllable, then they couldn't feel responsible for her death. It was something that just, you know, was beyond their influence.
Yeah.
She told me was about the fact that she'd had, as my grandmother called it, an affair with her headmaster. Now, of course, once I began to think about this story and I began to break the taboo and ask questions, one of the first things that occurred to me was, hang on a sec, a 15-year-old girl and a headmaster in his 40s, that's not an affair. That's something we would today use different language to describe. So I began asking questions. That was very difficult for me. I felt I was, you know, it was a double taboo in a way. I was not only asking questions about my mother, which was difficult enough, but asking about one of these hidden stories, of sort of dark stories of the past. Of sexual abuse. I found out who this headmaster was, what his name was. I found pictures of him. I eventually found letters that he'd written in an archive. I found out other information. And I eventually spoke to lots of my mother's school friends and other people who were at her school who gave me more information. And I became quite obsessed with this headmaster, this man, with what happened between him and my mother exactly. And what, you know, at first I think I thought that this was perhaps the magic bullet, the explanation for my mother's suicide. And of course, as time went on, I realized that it was a more, you know, as always, there's no one answer to a question like why did someone commit suicide?
Indeed.
That's certainly not in that situation. But for a period of months, I was utterly obsessed with this headmaster and was obsessed with finding out everything I could about him. And I discovered from a census from the early 1900s where he'd been living as a child, and I looked on Google Maps at the house that he'd been living in because it had the address, and I thought about going to see this house. And then eventually sense came to me. I thought, what good would it do me to go and look at the house of this man when he was 6 years old? So eventually I was able to move beyond that, although it haunts the book, that relationship, there's that episode, which lasted for quite a long time, as far as I can see.
And so clearly there weren't any of the resources available then that there might be available, that there are available now for folks who are potentially in similar situations.
Well, no. I mean, and nobody took it very seriously, I don't think. Up to a point, I don't know exactly how this happened. I've heard different stories, but at some point or other, I think what happened was that Hannah met one of her old school friends or comrades or people who were at school with her, school fellows, I guess is the word I'm looking for, who she discovered had also been abused by this man. And I think Hannah had thought of it as a love affair. And yet when she realized that this was a repeat pattern, she realized that at this point that you know, she had, because abusers tell abusees that it's love. They tell the abusee that abuse is love. Okay. So my mother had thought this was love, but she discovered that he was doing this to other people. And she then went, I think, to her parents. She was still young at the time, who went to the school, and the headmaster was fired from his job. Interesting. Of course, he then went on to work, as in those days they would do, at another school, although an all-boys school. So I think that the students at that point were safe, at least.
Well, not necessarily, but...
Well, I think for him, his interest was girls.
Okay, all right. You learned so much about your mom's time as a student. She was, as you say, she was energetic, she was outspoken. She was so often in her energy, in her creativity, in her forthrightness, if you will. She was also disapproved of. You know, she was a girl, and she was supposed to be more soft-spoken, and even to move more quietly was one of the comments that were given to your grandparents about your mom. She helped a friend get an abortion. I mean, these were all really kind of risky things in those days. What do you think about that young girl and that young woman who really seemed to grab onto life in such a different way from her peers?
Yes, I think that was in her character right from the start. Among the stories that my grandmother would tell me, what was how she, when she was, I think, 5 or 6 years old, she locked their neighbor in the chicken shed when they were living in the country, until the neighbor promised to stop hitting her son, who was Hannah's young friend. You know, so she was bossing adults around age 6. There was another story about how, when I think she was even younger, she dropped a penny on the bus so she could look up a Scotsman's kilt and see, as she put it, the thing itself. So she was curious, she was bossy, she was loud. You know, she wasn't particularly late, although she was, I think, you know, very attractive to men. She wasn't ladylike in the way that women perhaps were supposed to be in the 1950s. So she was breaking boundaries right from the start. And I think that was partly what confused the issue with the headmaster, is that, you know, this was a very, you know, very lively and characterful personality. She wasn't something on the whole. She was the person who did things rather than had things done to her. And this carried on. You know, I think there was this bump of the situation with the headmaster, but this carried on through her life. She was always at the forefront of things, always trying to push boundaries, to get more, to open up opportunities for herself and also for women in general. And she ended up being a sociologist after she went late to university, but when she did, she studied sociology, and she made the study of women and women's situation her subject. And her book, The Captive Wife, was composed of sort of a historical survey of the situation of women in the Western world throughout the centuries. But its main part was interviews with 96 women of her own age, young mothers in their 20s, and their experiences of being mothers, to some degree stuck at home with their children. And so my mother was pre-feminism. I mean, it was the time that Betty Friedan was writing The Feminine Mystique in America. It was the same time. So she was my mother was a pioneer feminist, and she was sort of writing about the difficulties that women faced, and also trying to sort of look at what possible solutions there were. And she was also trying to, at the same time as she was sort of, you know, a kind of an advance guard early feminist in the women's movement, she was also trying to live her life to the full. I've talked about how she embraced the 1960s, wore miniskirts, had her hair in a 60s style. She was also she was teaching at an art college, and the art colleges were very much in London the epicenters of the new 1960s. So she was being exposed to new radical ideas and political ideas, social ideas, sexual ideas. And she ended up having an affair with one of her colleagues. And I think my father was several years older than her. And I think he was more a sort of person of the 50s, more conservative, more sort of less forward thinking in some ways than my mother. And she was younger. She married him at 18. So she hadn't had much of a childhood. And I think that she was, I'm sort of rambling slightly here, but I'm trying to connect the personal and the political. She was both in her work, as a sociologist and in her life, trying to push the boundaries, trying to embrace the promise of the 1960s that women, as men, could have it all. They could have love, they could have sex, they could have work, they could have family, they could have fulfillment. And that was a difficult thing for a woman to be doing, and it meant that she came up against a whole lot of roadblocks along the way.
I would think it would have been also quite difficult for your father, her husband, given that you describe him as someone who was more traditional, and clearly he had married a young woman who was anything but traditional. Do you have any sense of what that was like for your dad?
Well, I think it all happened really late in the process. The affair, the changes. It was really the last 2 years of her life when she went to work at Hornsey College of Art in North London. And because, you know, my father, I don't want to give the impression that my father was a sort of, you know, a really conservative person. He was a successful entrepreneur who was very much at the cutting edge of his profession. He was quite a sort of stylish person who was sort of reading modern books and stuff like that. But he was less so than her. I mean, you know, she was really pushing the boundaries. And I think it did create conflict. He didn't mind the fact that she got out to work. He, in fact, encouraged her, which was quite unusual among husbands but in those days, to encourage her. But he still expected her to be there when she came home from work, to be making sure his shirts were ironed, his food was on the table. So as with, you know, I don't have to tell you as a man, as with women's lives, you know, throughout, certainly today also, you know, it's this balancing act between family and work and everything else. But it was the conflict came really very much towards the end. And in fact, it was my mother who forced the issue. She had this affair and then told my father about the affair and then asked him to leave the house. And he was still, in truth, I think, completely in love with her and was absolutely devastated.
His being told about the affair and then being asked to leave, that sounds like it would have been quite difficult for both of them, and certainly quite unusual.
I think it was. Well, yes and no. I mean, it's interesting. I think people tended to get married so young in those days. I mean, a lot of Hannah's friends were divorced. Got divorced. I mean, maybe she was perhaps one of the very earliest because she got married particularly young. But I think divorce wasn't uncommon in the 60s. People tended to get married very young, realize they'd made a mistake, you know, get divorced. This wasn't the 50s. This was changing. So that wasn't that unusual. But it was, I think it was certainly devastating for my father. He was, you know, very upset and I think very angry. The problem for my mother came, I think, in part because I think it's understandable. I think they were very different. When she married my father, when she met my father, she was 17. She was still very unformed. He was much old, not much older, 6 years older, not that much older, but he'd experienced life a lot more. He'd been to university. He'd been in the army in Germany. He'd been in the Berlin airlift. He'd parachuted from an airplane. He, you know, done lots of things. He'd had affairs before. She hadn't really. So he, I think, remained the same person. She changed. And I think it's understandable when I sort of researched the story that she would, in a way, want something. I mean, maybe they would have got back together. I don't know. But that she needed to fulfill herself more. She needed to experience life a bit more in a way that he had already done before they were married. Yet when the split happened, her parents, instead of supporting her, instead of saying, look, we understand, we'll support you as best we could, I think they were so shocked that they applied great pressure on her to get back with my father. So she didn't have, you know, she didn't have much support in what she was trying to do. And when the affair itself went wrong, you know, she was in trouble because she had no one to turn to, no one to fall back on.
What is your recollection, if any, of how the split between mother and father was described to you and your brother? Did you have awareness that their dad was now doing something different?
Well, I must have known because the last few months of my mother's life, my father wasn't living in the house. So I must have known at that point, but I must have forgotten later because I didn't, my father didn't talk to me, didn't mention my mother's name, apart from in those, I suppose, those early weeks after her death. He never spoke about her in the house I grew up in, and he only once talked to me about her. When I was 16, he took me for a drive, and he told me that her death had been suicide. Up to then, I assumed that I'd been told it was a heart attack. And he told me that her death was suicide, and he told me the brief story that she had fallen in love with this colleague at the art college, that, as he put it, this man had turned out to be homosexual and had rejected her, and she felt that she had messed everything up and killed herself. And at that point in that conversation, he also, I think he asked me, do you remember that I had, you know, did I remember that he had moved out of the house in those last weeks? And I remember saying, being surprised at that, and I didn't remember that. So that was how I was told. And that was it, really. I didn't ask any more questions, and he didn't tell me any more.
As you look back on that now, as an adult, you were 16 when your dad told you the truth of your mother's death. Did the timing make sense to you when you look back on it?
Well, you mean, did it make sense that he should tell me at that age?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I think they were wrong. He was wrong not to talk about my mother. I understand why he did it. I think today you would make much more effort to keep the memory alive. As painful as the death was, I think for the children, for young children, to both lose their mother and also lose the memory of her at the same time, I think it's a sort of double death in a way. But I can understand. I don't think, how do you tell a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old that their young mother has killed herself?
That's true.
It was a good thing to do not to put that extra burden on us. And I think by age of 16, I still didn't really know what to think about it, but at least I was able to understand. I knew that this happened and that people did this sometimes, and I could understand that she might not have been in the right, a perfectly good frame of mind and things like that.
Your dad letting you know that Mom had had an affair, what was your immediate reaction to that at the age of 16, 17 years old?
It's hard for me to remember exactly. I think I was a bit shocked by that. I remember I carried with me a kind of, I've never felt angry with Hannah. I'm always asked, do I feel angry with her? And I've never felt that. But I think I carried with me a sort of anger with him. My father was certainly angry with him, was angry with this man, and was also angry with a friend of my mother's who, in whose flat in Primrose Hill she had been meeting this man, and in his flat she killed herself. These were the two people my father sort of blamed, and who had also, he claimed, encouraged her to have the affair. So I think I carried that anger with him forward with me into life. But I wasn't so shocked about, I wasn't that shocked about Hannah having an affair, just because I didn't know anything about her and I didn't know her. So it wasn't as though it contradicted really any real information I had about her, because I had so little information. And in fact, the information I did have suggested that she was this slightly unreliable person who had an affair with her headmaster, who, gave adults a hard time when she was a kid, who was always pushing the boundaries. And another of the stories was how when she was driving, and she had one of those tiny little Fiats. I don't know if they ever made it to America, the little, even smaller than a Mini.
Yes.
And she would drive it on the pavement if she encountered traffic. This was the kind of character she was, according to the stories. So it kind of fitted in with all of that, yeah.
Jeremy, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to hear a little bit more about John Hayes and that relationship. Folks, don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey, certainly a significant man in your mother's life and thus the lives of everyone around her. Tell us a little bit about John Hayes.
Well, John Hayes was this man with whom she had the affair in the last months of her life. And I discovered his name as part of the process of researching this book. And I found in one of the things that I found when I went back to my old house where my stepmother still lives, looking for clues to Hannah, was I realized that that there were a couple of shelves of her old sociology books, and I started going through these, and some of them had her signature in and had markings in the margins. Like me, she always scribbled. She scribbled in books. I do the same, and there were actually. I found some other things, letters and things in these books. But one of the books had John Hayes' signature in this sort of spiky handwriting. And that was quite a shock to me that all these years that I'd been growing up there, this sort of mythical person, John Hayes, there'd been a book with his signature in the house. And I should just tell you, there was another extraordinary thing at the time. This is a slight side road, but I think it's interesting enough. I found... One of the books I found was a famous book on suicide by Emile Durkheim, a sort of French sociologist, called Suicide, Study, Suicide, a Study. And I found in the pages of that book, I found a flower, a pressed flower, very, very old, all the moisture gone out of it, and it had created ghostly impressions on the pages. And I don't know who put that there or when it was put there. But anyway, to get back to John Hayes.
That really is quite something, though, just the visual as you describe it, of that particular book and that particular flower
image. I presume somebody, after she died, had sort of gone into the garden and picked a daisy from the lawn and put it there in that book, particularly in that book. But I don't know who did it. I've never found out who did it. And I still have the book. I still have the flower in the pages inside. And John Hayes, somebody gave me his telephone number quite a long time before I contacted him and told me. And in fact, John Hayes was still living with the man that he had been living with when he had his affair with Hannah. The man he'd spent his whole life with. They'd met at Oxford University when they were 19 or something, and he was still living with the same man. And they were both called John. They were known as the two Johns. So I had this telephone number, but I just couldn't work up the courage to call him. And it was one of the very last things I did in the process of researching the story. I finally got the nerve to call him, and I spoke to him on the phone, and I think he was pretty shocked to hear from me, but he agreed to meet me. And we met at a hotel in central London, and we spent a few hours talking, a very emotional meeting. And he told me then that he'd never really spoken about Hannah's death before, and so he spoke about it then, and I think we both sat there in tears for a lot of the time. And he told me the story as he'd remembered it, of this, you know, charismatic, intelligent, very attractive person. And I think for him, he fell in love with her, mostly in a non-sexual way, and she fell in love with him and felt that, you know, his homosexuality was not an obstacle for her. And I think they consummated their relationship a few times. I don't think it was a very successful consummation from his point of view. But I think that she saw him in part as a solution to her problem. She was living with this older, quite dominant man, my father, or had been. She was looking for a sort of younger, more radical person with whom she could make the new kind of life of a new woman, a free woman. And, you know, John being her own age, a gentler character than my father, perhaps, seemed like the solution for her. And when he rejected her, I think that was a big shock for her. And I found that a surprise. It was one of the issues that I had to kind of get over, you know, because today a forceful, strong, charismatic woman would, you know, might want to have a man, want to have love, want to have fulfillment, but it wouldn't be something they would need to have, I would have thought. And certainly many women wouldn't feel they needed it all the time. And yet she seemed to feel that she was somehow couldn't cope without a man. And I went back and I read a lot of the feminist books of those times, particularly the Golden Notebook by Doris Lessing, which is one of the great novels of that period. And this is a book that, where women are struggling with this concept of the free woman, you know, and women are, women want to be free, but at the same time they need the security of having a relationship with a man, of being married, or and so it made me understand that these were different times, and that the strong woman today lives in a different world from a woman trying to be a strong woman back in the 1960s.
Absolutely. And she had two children, and she had put her husband out, and so there she was. And as I understand it, she had sort of insisted to John that they get married and live together and move forward, and it was when he said no that for her, it seems like it appeared all hope for a future was lost.
Yes, I think he for him, it was a sort of an exciting dalliance. You know, I think he was, you know, when she suddenly started talking about marriage and moving in with these two children, and, you know, I think he was shocked. It was like, you know, he already lived with someone. This was a, you know, I think he and the other John had a reasonably open relationship. They had affairs with other people. And for him, this was a very exciting affair. I think he really loved Hannah, but I don't think he'd ever thought of, you know, moving in with her. And also, he was homosexual. And so he was just, you know, he just withdrew. And I think probably, you know, as he described it to me, I think he was so shocked, and he was still also quite young himself and didn't know quite how to deal with this. And he didn't handle it very well. I think he, you know, in retrospect, he said to me that he could have handled it more sensitively, been more conscious of how devastating it was for her when he said no. But he didn't. And she... You know, when I look at it, it's even understanding the elements that we've talked about, and I looked also into her family history, and there's actually quite a history of suicide in her family, of women particularly in her family getting to a certain point of trouble and not being prepared to go any further. But this still remains a mystery to me, why she ended her life at that moment. You know, she still had so much to live for. I mean, it was a moment of despair, a moment of great emotional difficulty, but she had two children. She had this book coming out, which was a big hit when it came out in London. It caused a great stir in Britain. She had a good job. She had just been offered and accepted a new job. And, you know, life was beckoning for her. You know, maybe not a conventional life, but an interesting life was ahead of her. And I think of all she's missed out in the last 50 years, the grandchildren that she never saw, the children, her own children growing up that she never saw, the relationship she would have had with us, the friends, the career she would have had as you know, Britain's first sort of well-known feminist, perhaps even. You know, she would have been the British version of Betty Friedan. And she, none of that, all gone.
She had accepted a new position?
Yeah, in the last days of her life. I mean, literally like 5 days before her life. This was another element of the problems that she had been encountering, which sort of, I think, contributed to that sort of almost that perfect storm in those last days of her life. She'd had trouble getting her doctorate. Her book was based on her doctorate, her PhD, and she'd had trouble getting the subject matter approved, the study of women. She'd had trouble getting it, the doctorate awarded. It took a year of delay before it was awarded, which had made it difficult for her to get jobs. She was working at teaching on a general studies course at the Art College, but she really wanted to be a sociology academic, and she was applying for jobs and getting turned down, partly because she hadn't yet been awarded her doctorate, which she was eventually, but also because her male supervisors were giving her bad references, because I think they felt threatened by a sort of strong woman coming up through the ranks. I was told a story about how in one interview she went to at the London School of Economics, she was not given the job because apparently she was wearing too much makeup. And I don't think she wore much makeup. And so, you know, she'd had these problems. She'd been disappointed again and again in looking for the job that she wanted. And she did eventually get a good job. I don't think it was the job she wanted, but she did get a good job in the last days of her life. And she went and had supper 2 days before she died. She went and had a meal with the man who was going to be her new boss and another senior sociologist who was supporting her. So while I say that she had men who let her down, she also had men who were encouraging to her and nurturing of her. And she also, there's one of the interesting things, in those days in England, I don't know if they did the same in the States, and this is 50 years ago, when your checks, after they'd been paid and processed at the bank, they would send the stamped checks back to you. And these were one of the few things that survived. My stepmother had saved in the back of a cupboard a little packet of various things, including her return checks. And 2 days again, or 2 or 3 days before she died, she'd been shopping at somewhere called the Zing Boutique, which I think was probably in Carnaby Street, which is where she used to shop, which was the sort of great trendy street of the 1960s in London. So she'd been shopping for clothes, probably for her new job, only a couple of days before she died. So that decision to kill herself, while I think it may have been in her mind for a period, I think it came very, very fast, and she did it very, very quickly. And I think that was connected in part to her personality. That, as more than one person put it to me, that strength of character turned against herself.
Well, and that's what it sounds like, because she didn't do any of the things that one would imagine that one would do if they were actually contemplating suicide. Although having a family history of suicide, meaning that there would have been a family history of depression, could conceivably make her more vulnerable to it, but clearly, from what you describe, there was no evidence that that's where her thoughts were going. You were told by a family member that Hannah's suicide wasn't depression, more it was not being able to see a way she could cope. Do you agree with that assessment?
There's no sign of depression, and you know, normally depression is not something that emerges sort of in the last 2 or 3 days of your life.
Right.
You know, it's something that comes and goes, or it comes over a long period. And the suicides in her family weren't products of depression. They were both two of her aunts committed suicide, both actually after she died. So it wasn't as though she was influenced by them. And
I
they
see.
Died, and they were older, and they both were suffering from cancer. But they both killed themselves before they needed to die, and when they were actually in reasonably good health. And it was sort of, we're not willing to put up with this. So I think it was more of a streak of sort of an unwillingness to go beyond a certain point, that at a certain point of hardship or trouble or despair, and I think that's what she felt, was not depression, but despair, and probably a relatively despair that might have lifted quite soon afterwards. But that despair was so intense. And people have explained to me that at that moment, you can go into a sort of fugue state where all you can think about is ending the pain,
right,
and nothing else matters. And so you get focused on this one thing, which is to end the pain and the relief of no longer feeling. And I think that is the only explanation that I can really give to it.
You say that guilt is one of the most devastating legacies of suicide. Would you say that still?
Yes. Yes. I think that, for my grandparents and my father, and for friends of hers as well, I think that guilt, I think the guilt explains more than anything the silence. You know, how do you deal with that guilt, that sense that you've let the person down? How do you mourn when you're filled with guilt? You know, when I've experienced, you know, a young death of someone close to me, my brother, who died of a heart attack, and it was a devastating thing. He had three young children. You know, it was an awful event, but you know, nobody was responsible for his death. It was just bad luck, and so we could mourn him, and we've continued to be able to grieve and mourn him and love him and remember him. But he didn't reject us. You know, he loved his children. He, you know, he was a good father, a good brother, and all that. But how do you deal with the guilt that you've let someone like that down? And not just guilt. There are other things too: rejection, you know, anger, shame. I think all those things are a cocktail that's tremendously hard to know how to move forward, how to continue living in the face of those things.
What do you say to your daughters as you have told them about their grandmother?
Well, you know, they lived their teenage years, were living through the press. It took me 7 years to research and write this book, and that was really the period of their teenage years. They're now 21 and 19. And they sort of talked to me. I talked to them about it as I went along. They were interested, and they read the various drafts, because it took me a long time to write the book the way I wanted to. They read various drafts of it as it went along. So it was, they were wonderfully intelligent and thoughtful and supportive. And I'm not sure I could have done it without them, and certainly not without my wife, who is actually a family therapist. So she was an enormous help to me. Those are these three women in my household who were supporting me. And then they understood completely. The kids belong to a generation where everybody talks about everything. So to them, it seemed completely natural to do it. I've never had a bad word from them about anything that I've done in terms of that book. Lots of bad words about other things I've done, but not in terms of writing that book.
Well, that's part of being a parent.
Absolutely.
Comes with the territory. If there's one way you want folks to think about Hannah, what would it be?
Well, I think that what makes me feel good and what I'm proud of and what makes me happy is that I think I've brought her back to life again on the page. I mean, what suicide does is it doesn't only end the life. It changes the way we remember. It almost ends the way, to some degree, we remember the life. So all those photographs that you take of your family as they're growing up and, you know, that you intend at some point to look back and enjoy in your old age, you know, those photographs become sources of pain rather than sources of happiness, and any memory of Hannah became a source of pain. And I think what I've done, and so she disappeared behind the sort of scarlet letter of her suicide. And so what I hope I've done is I've brought her back to life. I've sort of given her life, you know, because she had 29 good years. I've remade that life valid again. So she becomes again someone from the past who we can remember and remember with a degree of fondness and with a degree of understanding. And that's what I carry forward.
Jeremy Gavron, author of A Woman on the Edge of Time, A Son Investigates His Trailblazing Mother's Young Suicide. Jeremy, are there places where folks can go for more information or learn more about the book?
Well, I'm afraid I have there's no website. I have no social media. It's just not my thing. I mean, the publishers, if they were to Google the title, they'll go to the publisher's website where they have information. And of course, the book is, available in all the usual places online and those wonderful institutions, your local bookstores. There's lots of information about it in newspaper articles and interviews and stuff.
Absolutely. It's impressive that you do not engage in social media.
Well, I'm trying to clear space to write.
I understand. Thank you, Jeremy, again so much for joining us today on Mind Talk.
Well, thank you very much, Pamela. It's been a great pleasure.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can always send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to mindtalk.org online, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store. And as I say very often, please always remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.